Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White, in for Vicky Gonzalez this morning. And ahead on today's show, we'll look at federal support for churches during the pandemic and how the flow of money intersected with race. You may have just heard a segment from Sarah Mises Tan during Morning Edition. We'll dig even deeper with her coming up in just a moment. Reveal did share data with local reporters around the country, and Sarah was able to go into the church version of that and found some very interesting stuff. There's also a newly formed group called Sacramento Picks It Up, and it already has hundreds of members, including myself. The group is made up of volunteers dedicated to making Sacramento a more beautiful place by picking up trash, and there's a lot of it. We'll speak with the group's founder about why she started it and what she hopes to see happen next. But first, the U.S. is facing a pandemic surge and a new challenge in how to get a handle on the highly transmissible Delta variant. A main goal for President Biden, increasing vaccinations among those resistant to getting the shot. Ken Rudin is a longtime political journalist and is the host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Very happy to speak with him again. Ken joins us now. Welcome to Insight, Ken.
Thank you, Randall. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning to you. So a lot has changed with the trajectory of the COVID pandemic over the past week. So I want to start there. Sacramento and Yolo counties are now just two of only three counties in California requiring face masks again for indoor public spaces. That would be like grocery stores. President Biden is calling this latest COVID surge a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Do you think that messaging is working for him?
Well, it's not. It's shocking that it's not, but it's not. And I think one of the reasons is because Joe Biden represents authority, and there seems to be a good portion, I say good in not a positive way, but a good portion of Americans who have just rejected authority. I think it's like 60.5% of all American adults have been fully vaccinated at this point, which is shocking given the fact that, as you say, the Delta variant is spreading so rapidly. They were like on Friday, I think we heard this in the newscast, but also on Friday in Florida, 21,000 new cases, which is the most it's ever had in the history of the COVID virus. So people are not paying attention. A lot of it is politics, because a lot of red state governors are saying, well, you know, something, we went through this before and we had the mask and we got rid of the mask. And now do we want to go back to this? It's government interference. It's interfering in our rights, as if seatbelts were an interference or polio vaccine was an interference. But somehow this has become political and people are just dying.
Yeah. UC Davis Health here in Sacramento has said that two of the main reasons that this surge is happening again is one, the Delta variant, and two, the unvaccinated. And Christian Sandrock, the director of critical care at UC Davis Med Center, says a number of younger patients, when they come in to the hospital critically ill, start saying, I should have gotten the vaccine. And then they start to get really sick and they'll say, why did I not get the vaccine? Why did I not listen? And Sandrock says more than half of the younger people that he sees coming in are saying that, Ken.
Randall, I'm glad you said that, because I see that in newspaper headlines all over the country from people, whether you're a Trump supporter or not, people who have been resistant, refusing, believing in conspiracy theories, refusing to get vaccinated in any way, shape, or form. And then you see them in the hospitals. I wish I had done that. I wish I had been vaccinated. And there was a woman who just saying that, you know, her husband refused the vaccine, lost her husband. I want to send this message to everybody else. Please don't become like my husband, who just refused to listen to science. You know, we could talk about politics until we're blue in the face about this, but it's also about life and death. And the fact that there are so many people pointlessly losing their lives because of refusal to believe in science, refusal to believe in reality. Joe Biden is doing what he can, but I think this country is just so ripped in half on issues like science, like climate change, like things like that, that I don't know what it's going to take unless we need everybody in ICUs to realize that this is real stuff. This is not because you're a Democrat or a Republican.
All right. Kent, there seems to be some confusion among the vaccine efficacy when it comes to the Delta variant. And we should be very clear that the vaccines are very effective against the Delta variant. Julie Rovner, the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, said this morning on Axios Today, it's a podcast, even if you get a breakthrough case, your chances of being hospitalized or dying are way smaller, like 25 times smaller if you're vaccinated than if you're not.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Julie Rovner, of course, the former NPR reporter, a wonderful person and smart as heck. But I mean, the fact is that I think it's zero. The people who are dying of this disease are plain and simple the ones who have not been vaccinated. The people who were in the hospital on ventilators have not been vaccinated. Those who have been vaccinated, are they immune? No, they're not immune. But the odds of getting deathly sick, losing your life, really has to do with getting vaccinated or not. It's black and white science.
Kent, what can Biden do differently to change this tone?
Look, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, you know, there is still, I mean, look, if half the country still believes he's an illegitimately elected president, if half the country believes that he's in power because of a coup, because Donald Trump does say that he's to this day, Donald Trump saying it was a corrupt election. I won by millions of votes. This is a fraudulent president. Well, what can he do to reach out to the half the country? Now, it's the young people. A lot of them are just saying no because, again, they may be rejecting authority. They may be more reachable. But I don't know if Joe Biden is the answer. Maybe you need some younger authority, younger like in the entertainment field or something about that. But somebody needs to do and I think they're starting that already, but there needs to be a national campaign about this. And I'm not convinced that Joe Biden is the right messenger or the perfect messenger for that.
And you mentioned the misinformation surrounding the election led to the January 6th insurrection. The Capitol Riot Committee held its first hearing last week in Washington, D.C. That, of course, comes 7 months after the January 6th insurrection. What do you expect to hear this week from the committee?
Well, the committee is still deciding who to call as witnesses. First of all, anybody who heard last Tuesday's testimony from the four police officers, it was just heart-wrenching and just emotional. And I mean, after you saw those four police members testifying, you saw right-wing media hosts saying that they're giving it, like, I think it was Laura Ingraham, and like, forgive me for even quoting her because she doesn't deserve to be quoted on this, but she was giving out awards for the fact that they were dramatic and it was phony and it was just a stage. And even Kevin McCarthy said, well, you know, it's not about the anarchists, it's not about the insurrectionists or the seditionists, it's about Nancy Pelosi. She's responsible because she didn't protect the Capitol. The Republican Party has just turned, again, I hate to keep harping on this, but the Republican Party has turned down, is no longer looking at reality, no longer looking at what actually happened on January 6th. They need a narrative. They need something to protect their party from a voter rebellion in 2022, especially if the voters think that the Republican Party was aiding and abetting this insurrection. So let's blame somebody else. Let's point fingers elsewhere. Nancy Pelosi is a perfect target, even though, you know, when the rioters broke through the Capitol, they were yelling, "Hang Nancy Pelosi, hang Mike Pence." I mean, the ugliness, the threat to democracy. You know, I've read so much about this, and there's something about this, and I hate to compare anything to Adolf Hitler because that's just, you know, that's a cheap way of making a political point. But the fact is, when Adolf Hitler tried his beer hall putsch in 1923, and it was laughed off, and it was defeated, but 10 years later he took power. Many people think that what happened on January 6th may have only been a dress rehearsal that can happen again, either in the national capital or state capitals around the country. It may not even be either. It may be everywhere. That it maybe was just a dress rehearsal because the anger has not gone away. The talk about a stolen election, thanks to Donald Trump's messages, has not gone away. And you can see newspaper reports that Trump has been raising millions and millions of dollars in small donations from Americans all over the country who feel that this is a stolen election, a corrupt government, and that's not helping anyone.
Kent, you mentioned California Congressman Kevin McCarthy and also former President Trump. Any chance they could get subpoenaed?
They could be. I mean, both Kevin McCarthy and Jim Jordan, the Republican congressman from Ohio and Trump supporter, who McCarthy tried to get on the committee, Nancy Pelosi rejected him, but they could be asked to testify. If not, they could be subpoenaed. I think that will happen. Remember when Kevin McCarthy, right after January 6th, talked about Donald Trump's responsibility and blame for what happened on the 6th. And McCarthy, of course, has changed his tune, but he has spoken to Trump, as has Jim Jordan. I think that they have a lot to say. You don't even have to have Trump on the panel to be subpoenaed. First of all, very few people believe the words that Trump says about anything. So just to have him on would be maybe a sideshow or circus. But I think a subpoena of Republicans who spoke to Trump during the hours before January 6th, the hours after it, would be very instructive.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with political junkie Ken Rudin about the latest happenings throughout the country and political landscape. Since we're speaking about Minority Leader McCarthy, he joked at a Saturday night event that it will be hard, this is a quote, will be hard not to hit House Speaker Nancy Pelosi with the Speaker's gavel if Republicans take control of the chamber in 2022, and he would likely become Speaker. I guess, what are the chances he becomes the next Speaker?
Well, first of all, I mean, if you're asking me right now, and of course I'm terrible with predictions, you know, I can't predict what's going to happen today or tomorrow, let alone in 2022. My gut tells me the Republicans do pick up the House in 2022. And that's one of the reasons why this infrastructure deal is so important, and everything that Biden is pushing is so important, because the Democrats have both houses nominally, you know, the House and Senate, and they've got to get things done fast because 2022 is rapidly approaching. But McCarthy, I mean, he was at this dinner and somebody gave him an oversized gavel, you know, and everybody cheered, yay, you're going to be the next Speaker. And he said, it's going to be hard for me not to hit a Nancy Pelosi with it. I mean, that's really hysterical, given the fact that just a few months ago, we're hearing people yell, hang Nancy Pelosi. So, I mean, how people joke about that. And of course, a lot of progressive Democrats are saying that McCarthy should resign from Congress. It's not going to happen. Of course, it's not going to happen. But the fact is that some people seem to be completely oblivious to threats of violence. And we saw that January 6th is no longer a theory about violence. It's very, very real. Mm.
You touched on the infrastructure bill. In a rare Sunday session yesterday, the U.S. Senate unveiled the new bipartisan infrastructure bill. It is thousands of pages long, and it clocks
2,702 pages.
Oh, wow.
I've read them all, actually. No, actually.
Oh, you have?
Netflix is going to show the movie. I can't read it. I'm going to wait for the movie.
That'll be riveting. It clocks in at nearly $1 trillion. How do you see this playing out? Do you consider this a big win for Biden?
Well, yes, but of course, we have a long way to go. Look, this is vintage Joe Biden. His whole career has been based on bipartisanship. He's been talking about bipartisanship from day one, even before day one. So, and Biden has been on the phone with Republicans for weeks and weeks and weeks. So I think the fact that they got this far, the fact that they got 17 Senate Republicans to go along with this bill that's going to be about just short of $1 trillion is a great victory, but we're still far from it being, I mean, and we're talking about roads and bridges and public transit and rail and water pipes. I mean, the things that are collapsing in this country that, look, when a bridge collapses and people suffer, you know, casualties, it's not Democrats or Republicans, it's Americans who, you know, go through this. So it should not be partisan. But there are still a lot of amendments that need to be passed. I think both sides will have their shots at it. And of course, there are a lot of progressives in the House who feel that the Democrats gave up too much. They wanted much more spending. They wanted much more for more things. So there are a lot of angry progressives in the House, in the Democratic House, that, you know, I mean, I think that ultimately they'll go along with it, but they're not happy. We still have a long way to go, but in the question you asked me 45 minutes ago, is it a victory for Joe Biden? I think so far, absolutely yes.
All of that spending that was cut from it that you mentioned is part of another dual track bill, right? A much larger one supported by the Democrats that still is a ways off from any sort of taking shape, right?
A very long ways off. We're talking about $3.5 trillion. And this is about childcare and housing and climate change and education. I mean, this is really a laundry list of what the Democrats want. But again, as I said earlier, and they're talking about voting on this bill as soon as the fall. But of course, 2022 is an election year. Things will come to a halt. Really, the time frame for the Democrats to get something accomplished is rapidly closing, and that's why. Once this infrastructure bill passes, and the assumption is that it does pass, the Democrats will go to this gigantic, as I said, $3.5 trillion bill that to this day, Republicans are still, at least with that price tag, very much opposed to.
Ken, we're running out of time, and I can't let you go without hearing what you think about the position of Governor Gavin Newsom here in California with the recall election fast approaching September 14th. Recent poll that we spoke about last week showed voters are split somewhat down the middle. I think the takeaway from that poll is that Republicans are far more likely to go to the polls or to vote in this case and mail in their ballots because there's just not the energy for the Democrats. What do you make of all of that?
I agree with that. If you're angry, you vote. If you're unhappy with things, you vote. And I noticed that registered voters, only 36% of registered voters support the recall, but of likely voters, it's like up to 47-48%. Mm. All the Democrats who are convinced that Gavin Newsom has nothing to worry about in the election, which is in 43 days, may be fooled. And then, you know, the Democrats, of course, they remind everybody about Gray Davis and Schwarzenegger. There is no Arnold Schwarzenegger on the Republican side that could unite a big turnout. And of course, the Democrats have tons of money, but the emotion, the intensity is on the Republican side. This could be a much closer election than anybody envisioned.
And is it a loss for the Democrats if it ends up being a close election?
Well, it'll maybe say something about Newsom's chances for re-election in 2022, not to mention his long-held dream about the White House. Look, a win is a win is a win, but a close win, I think Democrats will have to re-examine what happened. And a lot of it is not his fault. A lot of it is his fault. But the fact that we got rid of the masks, and now we may be reimposing the masks. We got rid of the closing of restaurants, now that we may reinstate the closing of restaurants. A lot of people are weary, and, you know, who do you blame? You blame the governor, rightly or wrongly.
All right. Randall and Rudin. Ken sent me a note.
Rock and roll.
Sent me a note this morning, R&R. Longtime political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Always great to chat with you. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, R.
Back to you, R. Up next, Cap Radio's race and equity reporter Sarah Mises-Tan joins the show with her reporting on how the federal government's financial support of Sacramento area churches during the pandemic depended a lot on race. You can join the conversation. Email us anytime, insight@capradio.org. Or use the Twitter hashtag #AskInsight. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. In for Vicky Gonzalez this morning, a reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting found earlier this year that in various major cities throughout the country, the rate of Paycheck Protection Program lending, you've probably heard PPP lending, was higher in primarily white neighborhoods than in neighborhoods of color. Reveal shared that data with local reporters around the country, including our very own Cap Radio health and equity reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan. And Sarah found something different. In Sacramento, the disparity in PPP lending was more pronounced for places of worship. Three times as much money went to places of worship in white neighborhoods compared with those in neighborhoods where people of color are the majority. Cap Radio's Sarah Mises-Tan joins us now. Sarah, great to chat with you.
Good to be here, Randall.
Always,
thank you.
Always good to dig in with you when you have this level of reporting that you do so well. Let's start with, you decided to take the data from Reveal and then zero in on churches. Take us down that path.
Sure. Yeah. And so I guess I basically downloaded all the data for PPP loans that were given to all businesses that were eligible to receive them across the Sacramento area. And basically, I would say the starkest difference that popped out was when we sorted that data for churches in particular. And so that's how we landed on churches. I'm not personally a particularly religious person, I guess, but it was interesting to see that, you know, actually for Sacramento, when we looked at the distribution of PPP loans for small businesses, I would actually say that that distribution was actually fairly equitable, I would say. And it was really only when we looked at and sorted specifically for church organizations that we saw there was this huge disparity when it came to what neighborhoods seemed to get the most amount of loans.
All the data crunching did it. Explain PPP for us, because it's a loan, right? It wasn't a grant. They weren't just getting the money.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting thing to talk about, too. But yes, at the basic level, the Paycheck Protection Program was a program meant to support federal businesses and other organizations like nonprofits and also religious institutions to help them weather the pandemic. I think most people have probably heard about this loan program through hearing how it helped restaurants in particular get through some shortfalls. And it was meant to basically help businesses keep their employees on payroll. So like I mentioned, interestingly, I would say that actually for restaurants in the Sacramento region, that was pretty equitably distributed, whether you were looking in, say, South Sacramento or Midtown. It went fairly equally to small businesses and census tracts that were majority people of color and those in majority white census tracts. But when we took a look at these religious institutions, we found a very different story. Again, I think the main finding is that despite the fact that Sacramento is pretty evenly split, when we looked at how many white majority neighborhoods Sacramento has and how many neighborhoods where people of color are in the majority Sacramento has, they're 50-50, but the distribution of these loans showed that religious organizations in white majority neighborhoods received 70% of the federal loan money that went to Sacramento. And that is incredibly dramatic. More concretely, they received a total of $20 million versus religious organizations in neighborhoods where people of color were in their majority. They received just a third of that money. So $7
million. So $20 million versus $7 million. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, interestingly, when we looked at like mixed neighborhoods versus majority white neighborhoods, we saw that they were getting the same number of loans from the federal government, but actually churches in mixed race neighborhoods were just getting less money than
Sarah, what were some of the barriers that kept churches in underserved neighborhoods from getting this money or applying? Did it start at the application process?
I think there are a bunch of different factors here, I'd say. But I spoke with Gabby Trejo of Sacramento Area Congregations Together. That's an interfaith advocacy organization. And she says Latino churches in particular struggled during the pandemic lockdowns. Here she is.
It is frustrating because when we look at the numbers of who got the loans, and we look at how Latino faith leaders were left out, and you know, African American faith leaders were left out, that data actually shows just a replication of what we already see in the community around investment in certain communities. And so it is disappointing and it is heartbreaking.
She says for smaller Latino churches in particular, there may have been a language barrier when it comes to accessing these loans. She says that also these churches often play a role that's a lot more than just the church in an underserved community. So just the burden of providing those other services during the pandemic may have made it so that they weren't as aware that federal help was available. Here she is again.
When we think about what congregations bring to our community, our congregations, our faith leaders, they're in the trenches, really providing that care for people.
And, additionally, a lot of the smaller churches that serve mostly Black or Latino congregants, they were often family run when I visited them, which means that a very small group was providing all of these resources for a community in need. So they didn't have large staff that could handle their federal application, and very few actually even had practical materials like computers or scanners that would be needed to send in documents for this application.
Yeah, I imagine it's paperwork heavy. For the churches that did get this money, how much of a help was it for them? What did they tell you?
Yeah, I'd say for the vast majority of churches that did get the loan money, it wasn't so much the amount, but just the fact that they received any money at all. About the average amount that went to a religious institution was about $50,000. And of course, when you think about how much went to certain businesses in the area, that's not a huge amount, but it also isn't small. So for smaller churches, $50,000 for a church in a majority white neighborhood, serving majority white parishioners meant not having to cut things like musicians or janitorial staff. It meant that they were able to keep community events going, like their food drive or like a clothing drive. I visited a lot of religious organizations across Sacramento last month for the story, and you could really see that difference that this money made. It was pretty stark. Some churches in majority white neighborhoods who did secure the loan mentioned that they didn't actually even see a drop in parishioners giving, while nearly all the churches that I spoke with who served people of color said that they saw a huge drop in donations.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, churches in white neighborhoods are mostly back to holding full services at this point with the music. There are people who welcome you at the door. Sometimes there's a bit of food. But for churches in communities of color, things felt very, very quiet. And you could really see that difference in that recovery gap. So most of the churches in neighborhoods of color, they weren't at full capacity yet. A lot of them were run out of more rundown buildings or operating actually in shared spaces with other organizations or other churches. There was maybe just one person playing music, or there was just a recording, and usually it's run by a family. So anything provided for the service is basically just done out of a family member's pocket.
Sarah, this all sounds very familiar in a way, and your reporting showed that this inequity tracks even further back than just the beginning of the pandemic, right?
Indeed. Unfortunately, it does. So I spoke with Paulina Gonzalez-Brito. She's with the California Reinvestment Coalition. They're an organization that helps connect communities of color with banks. She says the distribution of federal loans that we saw with Sacramento's churches is a direct result of redlining that happened in the city nearly 100 years ago.
You know, this really is about the long history of relationships, or a lack of relationships, that financial institutions have had with Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And I would even go further than that to say that there's a real, that in the DNA of the financial institutions themselves, that there is this discriminatory, it's not even behavior, it's a discriminatory policies and practices that exists. So often these banks don't even exist in our communities. They don't do the outreach in our communities, and they don't have the products that serve our communities. And what that results in is, a lack of trust in these banks.
A lack of trust in these banks.
Yeah, places that received less federal loan money were 9 times out of 10 in places that had been formerly redlined in Sacramento. So the government 100 years ago had explicitly told banks not to lend in these neighborhoods. And you can see that harm still happening today in 2021.
Sarah, tell us a bit about Vida Church. This is a church that had to close because of a lack of funding during the pandemic.
Yes. So Vida Church is a perfect example of what happened to many smaller Latino-led and Latino-serving congregations during the pandemic. Like many similar churches, they lost a lot of money when the pandemic forced them to go remote. A lot of their parishioners lost their jobs, and they just weren't able to spare any money anymore. And a lot of other parishioners got COVID-19, and the church really wasn't able to provide a lot of support during what was a pretty difficult year for them. Alex Valles is the lead pastor there and talked about how he saw a special calling for his church when he decided to set it up in North Sacramento.
Some of the dreams that we had here, you know, we really wanted to connect with the community, serve the community's needs. A big part, if not the gist of our faith, is to serve other people, to love people and serve people, meet people where they're at, show them the love of God in tangible ways, not just, you know, come to my church, you know, or receive a hug from us.
And, you know, Vida Church lost their lease as a result of this lack of money during the pandemic because they weren't able to pay their rent.
They sound like the perfect candidates for securing one of these federal loans. So what happened?
Yeah, you'd think so. But Pastor Alex and Vida Church, they didn't even apply for a PPP loan. Mm. It was a combination of factors for him. He says they heard about it a little bit late and they didn't have anyone on staff to help them navigate the application. It's actually just a one-page document, but Pastor Alex was worried that it would be complicated, which really speaks to what Paulina Gonzalez-Brito just told us about
Sarah, and I thought it would be too. I even said, I imagine a lot of paperwork, right? But one page, that's fascinating.
Yeah. It's actually relatively simple, and I think it really really speaks to that lack of a relationship that I think these communities have with banks, where they don't trust them to put out an application in which they would actually get that money or put out an application that they would be able to access.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, and also you mentioned these weren't grants, but these loans actually were forgivable. And that was one of Pastor Alex's biggest worries too, that kept him from applying. He was worried his church would have to pay this money back eventually. And he knew there was absolutely no way that they could, but the loans were forgivable. So all these loans that went out to churches in majority white neighborhoods, many of them have not had to pay that back if they use that money appropriately. And so again, I think this really just speaks to that lack of trust that we heard about and that lack of a good, meaningful relationship.
So in your reporting, you're looking at these churches. What about the broader community? What's been the impact of this unequal distribution of loans? Were you able to sort that out?
Yeah. So, you know, for Vida Church, they made the tough decision earlier this year to close their church for good. And that's meant for parishioners like Claudio Ramos Chile, who had attended their church for over a decade. She says she really misses the connection she found there.
The same feeling that I had leaving my family and my friends 30 years ago in El Salvador and feeling homesick about it, that's the way it felt. It felt like I left my family. It's painful not to, you know, gather, not to have that community with them.
Mm. And Vida Church served a mostly immigrant population. Pastor Alex remembers how his church actually would also play an advocacy role for many of the people who went there, helping people who had limited English speaking skills or were new to the country really get on their feet. So he knows it's a big loss for his parishioners to lose Vida Church. But like I mentioned in the reporting of the story, the good news is that Pastor Alex isn't giving up yet. He's hoping that they'll be able to relaunch Vida Church with more funding this fall. There weren't definitive numbers on how many congregations like Vida Church have had to close as a result of the pandemic. But we do know that the impact on just how many Latino-led churches and Latino-serving churches have had to cut back on services or pull back on things that they used to do, parishioners. The impact goes way beyond just a church. It's almost a community center.
Sarah, our producer, Cynthia Lopez, is wondering what, for the churches that did get the money, how was it mainly used? Where did they, how did it cover costs?
That's a great question. So the federal government required that a certain percentage, over half, I believe, maybe like 60% of the funding had to go to simply keeping people on payroll. So that's what it went towards doing. Yeah. And so sometimes the amount of money that you see churches getting is a direct result of just how many employees they already have. So it had to go towards first keeping people on staff, but then it also could have gone to things like paying the rent on your building, keeping utilities going, basics like that. And actually, I guess one of the churches that we spoke to, a mega church in Rosemont, they used it to actually make some new hires. They used it to be able to reopen their school in a COVID safe manner.
Is that Capital Christian?
Yes, that is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, these are legitimate uses. And I think you can really see just how much Capital Christian has been able to stay afloat as a result of the help of this money and honestly even expand their reach, which is great for them. But unfortunately, you know, for a place like Vita Church, who might have been able to benefit in the same way, even be able to keep their building had they gotten this loan, that just wasn't in the cards.
Sarah, you're so good at follow-up reporting, keeping track of things. I imagine that this huge project of yours might have some trails that lead into the future. Are you keeping tabs to see where things lead?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I think what I was surprised by, and I'm not a religious person, so mostly just interested from seeing this, is just following up with a lot of these families who didn't apply for the loan and who interestingly told me they didn't apply because they thought other churches deserved that money more, which I thought was very selfless of them. Mm. And these were just small churches in South Sacramento and North Sacramento that really did need that money, I would say, and probably maybe needed it more, arguably, than some of the churches that did receive it. But they just said, you know, somebody else needs it. We're not even going to apply. So I really am curious to follow them and just see the arc of what happens with their church. They are still, there are so many of these open, still operating, but I know a lot of them have cut back on a lot of types of services. So things like summer camps, they're not running those, or back to school clothing and supply drives, they're not doing that anymore. And so I'm curious to see that longer standing impact in these communities.
Sarah Mises-Tan, Cap Radio's race and equity reporter, thank you for sharing all of this information, including that last little bit there about the churches feeling like other churches would need it more. That says a lot.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me, Randall.
All right. Still ahead, we're joined by the founder of a newly made volunteer-led group dedicated to cleaning up parts of Sacramento where trash builds up. Pretty much everywhere. You can join the conversation with us. Email us anytime, insight@capradio.org, or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. And you are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host this morning, Randall White, in for Vicky Gonzalez, who's taking a much-deserved day off. A growing number of Sacramento residents are hitting the streets to pick up trash and then post about it. It's all part of a group called Sacramento Picks It Up, which was formed on Facebook about 5 months ago, and it's already up to more than 400 members, including myself. It's made up of entirely of volunteers who, you know, go around picking up trash on streets, sidewalks, off ramps, the riverfront. There are often multiple posts each day from members showing large trash bags filled with garbage and, you know, before and after shots of the cleaned up locations. Allison Seconds is the founder of Sacramento Picks It Up, and she joins us now. Welcome to Insight, Allison.
Thank you so much for having me here to talk about this amazing group.
We're talking about how it's all in Sacramento, but this weekend I saw you posting pictures from Lake Tahoe where you were, even when you get away, you're still picking up trash.
Well, that's kind of the fun of it too, because wherever we go, Sacramento picks it up. I'm from Sacramento. I'm still going to pick it up.
I like it. And you promote the hashtag. You don't have to become part of the Facebook group, but you can use that, just the hashtag on whichever social media service you're using, hashtag Sacramento picks it up.
Absolutely. And it's just a way to share what you've done. And also in that way, also spread the idea of just picking it up.
Kind of making it Sacramento's thing, right? That we're known for, that we don't just walk past a candy wrapper on the ground.
Well, that's exactly how it started for me. And I'm sure a lot of people just had that epiphany. You know, you walk by trash. We have a legitimate trash problem in this town. A lot of towns do, but I think, you know, we previously have been known as the city of trees, and I really just don't want us to be known as the city of trash, and it is getting to be that bad. But yeah, a lot of us have had that epiphany of walking by and just kind of tisking, you know, oh, that's such a shame, look at all that trash. And then we're like, wait a minute, why don't we just pick it up? And that's legitimately how I came to this idea of Sacramento Picks It Up. Although it's kind of funny, I actually started, I wanted to call it Sacramento Pick It Up at first, which is kind of a little more aggressive, like, come on, Sacramento, pick it up. And my sister said, you know, Sacramento Picks It Up might be a little bit more welcoming.
Right? No, I can see that.
And I do want to keep it very positive. I think that we can, instead of focusing on how upset and frustrating it is, we can just start doing something about it and feel good about it. And so that's another main kind of message that we're trying to get across.
Well, Allison, people seem to really be glomming on to whatever vibe you're putting out there, because the group has grown quickly. My husband and I would walk our dogs in the neighborhood during the pandemic. There wasn't a lot to do before vaccination, of course. And at some point I was like, you know what, I'm going to get a bucket and buy one of those devices that allow you to grab things. I didn't want to touch anything. You know, I still don't. But
right.
And I just started picking things up. And then somehow in my Facebook feed, I saw your group and I was like, oh, well, wait, that's what I'm doing on Saturdays and Sundays. So I started following. But what I do on the weekends is far less than some of the people in the group are really what would be the right word for this?
Motivated,
jazzed. Like they go out there and they just collect huge, huge sums of trash.
For sure. And we have so many different kinds of people doing different kinds of things. And one of them is so impressive, especially as when I started the group page, I got a foot injury. So right then I couldn't really go out. And so I'm literally sitting back and watching these folks just go to town. There's some people on the group that are so highly motivated. They'll go out and we're talking several trash bags, trailers full of trash, cleaning up abandoned encampments or just, just trash on the road. And then we also have members who are filling their first bag in their neighborhood. And it runs the gamut, and it's exactly what I was really envisioning with this Sacramento Picks It Up, where, like you said in the beginning, I thought I was just walking the river as I do every day, seeing the trash building up, starting to pick it up, and thinking, what if Sacramento became known as, you know, a town full of people that pick it up?
I love
and
that.
And there's a bunch of us. You're one of them.
Yeah. You know who's really prolific is Lisa Sanchez. I see posts from her constantly. And then and she's even sort of in the organizing mode where she's like, you know, I'm not just going to do this on my own. How about you? How about y'all come out here with me and creates an event out of it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's part of the group is to learn and share strategies. It goes faster when you have people. So anyone can get on here and organize an event. And it could be last minute. We've had last minute pickups people join or truly planned events a week in advance. And it goes faster and it's more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people that want to help. Obviously, they're joining this group and several other groups. We're not the only one, certainly in Sacramento. But we're kind of gathering a little bit more. We've got members from the Elk Grove Anti-Trash Community Cleanups, an amazing group that also does large pickups. I could name a lot of other groups.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, we're all kind of congregating and we're joining other groups, they're joining ours, and it's just growing.
Allison, one common thread that I see from people in the group is that they wonder, hey, I don't mind going out and collecting this trash, but then what do I do with it? Like, how do I dispose of it? What's your advice there?
Well, that's another main goal of the group. As it started to grow, we were tackling these questions, and it is becoming a place. We're actually compiling contacts for the city, for county, Caltrans. We will have that available this week, actually, for group members to look at. And we're really advocating strongly to utilize things like the 311 app, calling the city to report trash pileups, and they will come out and get it. There are parameters, and so again, this is a great group to come to and learn these things.
Uh-huh.
You don't have to pick stuff up. I mean, if you see a pile that's been growing, you can call, put in a report. And
I've done that through 311, and they've been there within less than a week. You know, how much of it is the responsibility of the city, and how much is it the responsibility of the members of the group, of the people of Sacramento, just in general and surrounding communities? David Irons says, I would suggest that those of you in Sacramento reach out to your most local form of government, your city council person. Is that a good path?
Absolutely. We don't do it enough. I think that we need to voice our concerns in these very direct ways. And we are filling in the gaps for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And we are needed. I don't think that, you know, we can't just sit back and have the city and county take care of it all. That's not where, as Lisa Sanchez retorts to some folks who say, well, you know, the city should do the work. And she said, I love this retort. It's, well, so how's that working out for you?
Oh,
you
right.
Know,
yeah.
It's not, and I've said similar things. Like we can't rely on them completely because there's so much trash, but we can certainly get a hold of our council members, and they're responsive. That's their job. And if they're not, we'll hold them to the fire, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of passing the buck. We've noticed trying to get a hold of certain officials and organizations, but for the very most part, they're coming out because we're calling them or we're asking them for these things.
Well, Kathleen,
so it's very important.
Kathleen Ford says, my biggest frustration is the utter lack of garbage cans in heavy pedestrian areas. And then she says, namely Midtown. And then also, of course, the Caltrans areas where you see a lot of the trash building up. So when it comes to the trash cans, what's the rules for when the city will put a trash can somewhere?
Well, we're learning this as we go. And it has to do with the almighty dollar, of course. But one of our members, Deborah Van Holstein, has reached out to her city council member and she's putting in a request for cans in Midtown. So there could be a little bit of, progression in that area. So we're finding out, we're learning as we go, like I said, and as if we push and we voice our concerns, our city officials need to listen. And let's face it, there are not enough garbage cans in Midtown walking along. We hear that a lot. Where do you put the trash? So we need them. And then we really have to address the trash that is piling up because of our unhoused citizens. They don't have anywhere to put this stuff. And I insist, because I do talk to, I'm a homeless advocate in a lot of ways, helping folks along the river with their camps, etc. But I insist that a lot of these homeless folks, they don't want to live in such trash either. Now, just like perfectly housed people, some people care more than others. So we've got people in cars throwing garbage out of the window, and we see that. I just saw it the other day. So there are
cigarettes on the ground. So many cigarettes on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cigarettes. My gosh. Micro trash. Arama.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've got homeless folks who care and homeless folks who don't care, and housed folks that care and housed folks that don't care. So
And there are
There
are some safety issues too. So if you decide to go out on your own and start picking up trash, you know, keep safety in mind. Do not pick up disposed needles, those sorts of things. I just want to close
We cover that in the group too, that we're talking about how to deal with that and where to turn those in. And yes, using grabbers is highly recommended.
Yeah. Allison, I gotta close it there. I just want to say I like Alec. Isaac Gonzalez says, many hands make for light work. And I love that in terms of the group. Allison Seconds is the founder of Sacramento Picks It Up. Thanks for taking time to join us today and for creating this group. I love being a part of it.
Oh, thank you so much.
Our Ed Fletcher is also a part of it. I should mention that. All right, that's Insight for today. Learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, you know, wherever you get your podcasts. And I'm your host, Randall White, in for Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks again. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.